podcast that you're about to hear comes from a program titled The RSL, A Time to Celebrate. These sessions have been facilitated by Christian Teusner from the Emu Tree in partnership with the Wakery RSL sub-branch. To explore further podcasts, visit thewaywewere.podbean.com. My name is Christian Teusner. Thank you for listening.
I'm here with Jenny McIntosh. Jenny, thank you for agreeing to meet with me and share some stories today. Could you state your full name and your date of birth, please?
Jennifer Judith McIntosh, 2nd of the 9th, 1934, in Melbourne.
So you were born in Melbourne, yeah? Mm-hmm. Could you tell me a little bit about your early childhood?
Yes. My parents were Cleveland. My mother was nicknamed Pat. My father was Kenneth. She was actually Edna Blanchford Kennedy, but got nicknamed Pat. I lived in Melbourne until 1940 when we were, because of the war, my father, who was an insurance inspector of farming, was sent to Wangaratta, or Wangaratta as it's now called, was Wangaratta, and we lived about some distance, over 3 miles out of the city, and I had to walk as a six-year-old 3 miles there and back to school every day. I started at the public school. There were 60 in the class, and I was going backwards very fast. And my mother took me out, and because we were over 3 miles out of the town, she gave me correspondence for 6 months, caught me up, and then I ended up with a choice of going to back to the public school, to the convent. She was a rabid anti-Catholic. Or possibly they would try and send me to boarding school. I knew that was more than difficult for them. So I opted for the convent and spent till 10 there. Then we went back to Melbourne and I went to a private school. Unfortunately, contracted rheumatic fever. When I was over it, the doctor said I could not go back to that school because they didn't have heated classrooms. And so I went to St Catherine's. The first one was Lauriston. Went to St Catherine's and finished school there in 1952, aged 18. At that stage, Bob had come into my life. And 6 weeks after I left school, we announced our engagement. This was because he was going to Korea as a fighter pilot, and my father was happy to give permission. So that was 27th of February, 1953, and we were married on the 27th of April, 1954. We had to choose the 27th because he'd left for Korea on the 27th of March. The armistice was signed on the 27th of July. He arrived back in Australia on the 27th of November. So the 27th became important.
Can you tell me a little bit about your early courting days with Bob?
Well, because I was at school. He was most of the time he was learning. He had learned to fly somewhat before he joined the Air Force, but most of the training was at Point Cook, although he did leave for Wagga and Archerfield, so he was away a bit. But I was the only person he knew in Melbourne due to the fact that I'd been staying with my aunt and uncle in Sydney when I was 16 and he'd met me there. So he'd come to see us, with my aunt having told him she'd write and tell him he was coming. He didn't know, she never wrote a letter. So he turned up on the doorstep suddenly one Saturday, and I answered the door and thought, it's Bob Mac something. Neither of us had made a great impression on each other in Sydney. Yeah, he was then 21 when I was 16. And so I invited him in. and because he thought we knew all about him. I couldn't remember his surname properly. He had to introduce himself. And so most of the weekends he had free, he would come and stay with us. And fairly quickly, things started, were very interesting. And gradually, over the time, things got very serious. Mainly because he was there each weekend, and we just clicked right from the word go at that time. So that's how that came about.
And did you have any idea at that point in time that this was the man you were going to spend?
By about the middle of 52, things were very serious and getting more and more serious. So, yes, I was pretty... The thing was, I had hoped to do medicine. So really I had the choice when we announced out, when we decided to get engaged, that if I got engaged, that was the end of university for me. Because in those days you could not change universities during a course. And I knew that we would be moving pretty constantly. And so that was the choice I made.
That was an easy decision, was it?
An easy decision. It was. It was an easy decision. And I haven't regretted it. We went from Melbourne to Nelson Bay. Bob was flying at Williamtown. He was in Vampires to start with, and then went on to Sabre Trials. And we had our first child in July 55. So about 5 weeks before I was... Before I was 21, and of course in those days 21 was the legal age, and I was really incensed when I got the birth certificate to find that infant had had infant. I was not impressed, since it's only 5 weeks till I was 21. And then I was expecting number two when he was posted to instructor's course in Sale, East Sale. I planned to go there, although baby was due the day after the course finished. But when I got to Melbourne, my mother was not at all well, and I decided to stay in Melbourne, and Bob came up each weekend. Fortunately, my first girl, had been early. My second one, a boy, was on time, so he was back for it. So that was some of the early bits. After he was born, we spent 10 months in Melbourne, then off to Perth, to Pierce, where we had a couple of houses. Second one on the base, and he was flying Vampires to start with. Came home one day and said, "You're not going to like this. I have been seconded to 24 Squadron, I think it was. Anyway, the squadron in Perth, with civilians there, to teach them on to Wirraways." I had made the only mistake I made in the Air Force by saying, when he was flying Wirraways at Sale, saying, "I don't like Wirraways." Or when he was flying Melbourne, actually, it's Wirraways. I said, "I don't like Wirraways," because they were virtually obsolete. They were robbing Peter to pay Paul. And I hadn't worried about him being on Sabre Trials or any of the others. So I learnt my lesson to never say anything again. Not that I minded any of the others. So then we were posted to Melbourne again, only this time he was going to fly what they call a mahogany bomber, a big brown desk in Department of Air. The only problem was that I was expecting my third baby the day we were to move, so I had to go to the doctor and say, "This baby has to arrive a couple of weeks early." His reply was, "Oh, my babies are late at the moment." I said, "I don't care about your babies, only this one." Well, it ended up, after a bit of toing and froing, I got a medical induction, and she did arrive on our fifth wedding anniversary, the 27th of April. And so left for Melbourne with a two-week-old baby and two small toddlers. Bob had been over in Melbourne and came back after she was born, and then came back to pick me up. So I had to do all the packing and stuff. or organising packing. So we spent 10 months there. Then the whole department moved to Canberra, and so we went to Canberra with a... we were 2.5 miles out of Civic, and we, as we drove down the street we were to live in, there's a detour sign just about 3 or 4 doors from our house because the road hadn't been finished. And so we got to the house and got in there, and there was quite a... There's a story in here that you could read about that. So we spent... Or he spent the next over a year in the department, and he happened to be mowing our lawn at the back one day when the officer behind us, was who was in charge of postings for officers, called him out. He was mowing his lawn, called him over to the fence and said, "How would you like to fly helicopters?" Well, because he was waiting to fly anything to get out of the big brown desk. So he said, "Yes, anything to fly." He said, "Well, you'd have to go to America to train on helicopters." He said, "Yeah, okay." So that ended up, I was left with 3 children while he was away for 7 months in America. Families could not be posted overseas unless it was 12 months. They had a nasty habit at that stage of posting people for 11 months and then adding a month later. But this time it was 7 months.
It must have been a tough time for you.
It was. It was. As I've said in here, I didn't even get a phone call to see how I was going. That would not happen today. But it was tough. Son aged 2.5. When the first letter came, he went as white as that sheet and went to be sick, came back and listened to it, and I read the letter to him. After that, Bob bought a couple of little, very small tape-to-tape decks that had just come out. This is 1960s. And we had to have a series of batteries because if one taped on full battery, you had to listen on a full battery. If it was taped on a low battery, you had to listen on a low battery. And once they came, he was fine. Once he heard Dad's voice, there was no trouble. So that happened while he was away. And then he came back to Canberra, because people spend a lot of time in Canberra in the services. And we had put a deposit on the little government house we were in, and we added, it was pretty small, we added a family room on then, and then I was pregnant with my 4th child, so I ended up with a girl, so it was... Girl, boy, girl, girl. Unfortunately, I nearly died when I had her, which was a pity. I wasn't bonding with her very well because I was in hospital. And so about 6 months later, we'd waited till all the postings overseas were filled, and because we had a little Hillman Husky at the time, and it was getting a bit small with 4 kids, and so we waited till all the overseas postings were filled and decided we'd buy a new car. So we bought a Toyota Crown, but Bob went away for 3 weeks and it was in his name, so I couldn't pick it up. Never happened again, it was always in joint names. He came back on a Sunday and I asked the commanding officer if he could have part of Monday off to pick up the car. He said no. And I said, "Oh, come off it. So-and-so. He's been away for 3 weeks. "Oh, okay." So we let him have part of the time off. So Monday we picked up the car. Tuesday morning I got a telephone call. We're posted to Malaysia, which was fine. This is because they'd worked out he'd been away for more than anybody else in the helicopter squadron. He'd virtually been away 2 years out of the last three. He went for 3 months to Darwin where everybody, and set up attachment. Everybody else went for a month, that sort of thing. He was the first to do flood work. I've got a lovely cartoon from that. Of course, that meant the car. So we lost £500 on that one, taking it back 8 miles to the car people.
That was it. That was the
distance. We'd driven it, so it was ours. So 500 pounds later. But we went to Malaysia. We had a lovely time. We sailed up, which was lovely, on an Italian boat. And since my youngest was a blonde baby, the Bambino, we were given a special time. Except that there was no laundry and washing nappies wasn't so... No disposable nappies. Washing nappies wasn't so easy. But never mind, we managed. And so we lived on the mainland of Malaysia. Unbeknown to me, Bob was being shot at because he was going up in the jungle with the helicopters and it was confrontation on. He never mentioned that. April 65 towards the end of the year. The squadron was, the helicopters were sent back to Australia, but the men went to Vietnam with other cops because they weren't allowed to go from Malaysia to Vietnam. But the men went. And so, and Bob was the one clearing up the thing, so he was a little bit later than the others going. There were some funny stories out of that. Anyway, he went to Vietnam in May or June for a year. However, I got a message from him. He got back for 3 days on one occasion because I had 3 sick kids. He was extremely tired. They'd been flying for dawn to after dark, 7 days a week for 5 weeks. So he was extremely tired. So he slept most of the 3 days. And then he went back to Vietnam. Then I got a message saying, we need to get back to Australia ASAP. Will you please arrange movement back? And we have to be back as soon as possible. Now, this was in March 66. So he didn't do the full year because he was wanted back as a chief flying instructor, but he also happened to be made acting commanding officer as well. I fortunately was able to arrange for us to sail back. So he had that 10 days sailing back, which gave him a break. One other pilot came back, flew back, started straight away, no leave. So he got back and started straight in. He had 4 students and commanding officer. The other instructor had 5 students. And I kept being told cheerfully, oh, Bob will kill himself, he's so tired. That was very helpful to a wife. Anyway, at the end of 66, he went on leave. And that was the year that Holt went missing. So he immediately rang the base and said, oh, you want me back? Because he was regarded as the ace pilot in helicopters. And they said, no, sir. So he was very offended about this. And it wasn't until he went back. When he went back to work, that he found his papers had been marked not to be recalled in a national emergency. They had recognised how tired he was. We'd bought another house and sold one house, bought another house in Canberra, and in the meantime, but he had another go at flying a big mahogany bomber. Both of those were in flying safety, those jobs. Which probably was the best thing he could be for a bomber, brown bomber. And then he went back to the helicopter squadron, and in 74, he was backward most of them in the squadron. Again, he was CO of the squadron by 1974 when we were posted to Edinburgh, and he was made commanding officer of the base squadron. By that stage, we had 1 married daughter, a son and a daughter at Canberra Grammar, boys and girls, finishing their education, and a 10-year-old. So we brought the 10-year-old over here, put the others into boarding school, and came over in... Well, Bob came over in July 74. I waited out the term, came over in the end of August 74 with the children. We were sent for 18 months. And towards the end of 75. I said, oh, by the way, where are we posted? And he said, funny you should ask that, because today I got a telephone call asking me would I stay on for another year. I said, the Air Force don't ask. He said, well, they did this time. So they did that till the each year, till the beginning of 78, and he retired the end of 78. By that time, had decided to enter the Uniting Church, and so he went to Park and Wesley as a student, and we bought an old house in King William Road, an old blue stone with five bedrooms, with Bob and another man doing rewiring the place, another officer who'd retired, and he got his electrician's license on the... And that was a funny story, because it had been owned by a Greek family, who, and he had rewired the house. It had an old board, timber ganger and things, and one marble ganger, and it really was a mess, the wiring. So poor Bob and this other friend rewired in a heat wave, and he did it by the book. And most of the time, they'd only just started to rewire, to earth them and allow it. So the first thing they did when they came to inspect was look at those and say, you can't have those. And I said, they're all earthed. They checked every one, and Bob nearly didn't, the last one, he said, oh, but they checked it was all done. So that was okay. And then they went up in the ceiling to check. They said, oh, this will last for years. You've done it by the book. I thought, well, you know, either you have the book and you do it, or you alter the book or throw the book out. Anyway, that was all passed very well. So there was a lot to do, and we didn't have enough money to do everything we wanted to do in the house. Anyway, we were there for the three years that he was in college. He was then we went to Bordertown for 3 years. Meanwhile, we let the house out and to struggling students, so we didn't get a lot of rent. And then we went the 9 years to Meekatharra, which is spelled M-E-E-K-A-R-R-A, and it rhymes with Yarra, and had the 9 years there. And again, he retired at the end of that, so that would have been end of... We were there from January 85 to December 93, and then he retired in 94. And they asked us to do a few other things after that. We went for 6 months as another patrol. This was patrol... Those days they were called patrol padres, and me, occasionally I got called patrol madre, just occasionally. Now they cook. Then they went to patrol ministers when women came in, and now for some funny reason they've gone to bush chaplains. The new director decided that. My bet is they're still called patrol padres, patrol ministers. But we went to Exmouth for 6 months, which seemed crazy because you really need lots of time to get to know people. However, what we didn't realise was that Exmouth was a patrol running along the coast, slightly inland, and our patrol met that patrol inland. We had an aeroplane because we had such a big patrol. It was half the size of South Australia. Yeah. But the Gascoigne patrols were called then, was not terribly big. So we had a four-wheel drive. The padre that had been in there had had a terrible, terrible accident 2.5 years before. He was going to learn to fly and take over from us, but he never was able to well enough for that. So he had only been able to drive up and down the sealed road. He couldn't go on the rough road. So the inner people hadn't had anyone for a couple of years. And they said, we just want you there for 6 months. Someone's following. It's a silly time. Anyway, what we didn't realise was that we had met a lot of them at picnic races and things. And if we hadn't met them, they had a relative or a friend in our patrol and had heard a lot about us. Mm. So we got a tremendous welcome. And the very first station we called on happened to be one that hadn't heard of us because he'd only been there about 3 years, and he was sort of way up one end of the patrol. And he said, "Oh, Padre, would you pray for rain, please? I've been in drought ever since I got here for 3 years." So Bob had always done this, never very successful, often more, 6 years of the nine were drought in the Murchison Patrol. And so Bob did, and two hours after we left, he got 40 mils. That goes round the patrol. And so everywhere he was asked to pray for rain, which he did, and at everywhere we went, it rained. And one particular station, we stopped after this particular station because everyone had had rain, that went on and stayed the night elsewhere, came back through there, and they said, "Bob, you overdid it a bit. We got 8 inches. We had the kitchen flooded. It was a separate building. And so we stopped praying for rain then. And later on, we were at the Gascoigne races, and of course we met lots of people from our old patrol as well as the new. And one of our old people said, "Oh, you know you won't be allowed to go, don't you?" And I said, "Oh, why is that, Ross?" And he said, "Well, look at the rain you've brought." I said, "Oh, yes, pull the other leg, you know. We 6 years out of nine drought in Murchison. Oh, yes, but you've learnt now." So, but anyway, we left. We had another time doing a survey along the trans line, just doing a survey for them, and then back along the air highway. They wanted to see whether they need to put in a patrol there. And that was just after a cyclone. So all the very sharp rocks were washed clean, and a lot of them were pointed up like this. So I managed to shred a tyre going up a hill and sliding just a tiny bit onto a rock. And you feel a bit vulnerable. We always took two tyres, two spares. You feel a little bit vulnerable when you're down to one. But fortunately, we'd nearly finished the trans line, and we were going back through a station and back to Ayres Highway. So that was a bit of that.
Can I ask you, Jenny, please, you'd mentioned that you'd spent 9 years at Meekatharra. Could you talk a little bit about that period?
As I say, I learnt to fly there. Our plan originally was to visit each station twice a year, at least. It never quite worked out that way. There were various interruptions, plus it was pretty hard to get round everywhere twice a year. But we also had six towns, so there was services every week at Meekatharra. We had Wiluna, Sandstone, Yalgoo, Mount Magnet, Kew. Meeka was the biggest. When we went there, there were 800-odd people, ended up 1,600 because of mining around the town. It's not way back because the mines have closed. Magnet was about the same size as Meekatharra. Kew was smaller. Kew had the most beautiful sandstone buildings that had been arranged by Herbert Hoover, the next president of the United States, who was there and had built as if it was going to be town of the Murchison, I think. Lovely sandstone buildings. Meekatharra had big wide streets because they used to, most of them had big wide streets because they used to have the camels coming up through and they had to be able to turn around. Sandstone and Yalgoo had a population of 40 each. Wiluna, it varied from 50 to 500 Aboriginals and about 40 white people there. And as I say, and we had one time, we used to fly down to Sandstone once a month for a service, and we didn't have a church there. We only had one in Meeker and Mount Magnet. So we would use the Anglican church. The only problem was that half of it had fallen down and the other half, where the minister was up, was tied up with wire. And I was always a bit worried about it. But we could walk from the strip, which ended near the town, and we could walk to church, which was fine. We had heard that the Catholic Church, the only other church there, was in worse order. than the Anglican Church. That wasn't a proposition. Well, then they had a baptism in the Catholic Church, and they cleaned it. Five people came in and cleaned out where the kangaroos and the goats had been in, or the sheep rather, sheep and kangaroos. And the shire clerk, who was a Catholic, put two doors on it, and it was really good. That time we had a very good relationship with the Catholic priest in Mika, and he said, you're welcome to use it any time. So we'd had a look at it. We flew down one Sunday, and I said, OK. We'd told them that we could use the Catholic Church, our parishioners, and they kept walking at it. We were going using the Anglican Church. I said, OK, don't care where we have church today, but it's not going to be in the Anglican Church. I want a husband at the end, and the wind's in the wrong direction, and the wall will flex. Might come in. OK, we'll go to the Catholic Church. So we had to taxi through the golf course, which we did. Got it all set up, and everyone came in, and everyone was very happy with it. We had Catholic Church thereafter. 3 weeks after this event, the Anglican Church fell down. Wow. So it was good timing. The upshot of that was that in 1994, we had to go back to Sandstone for their centenary. The Catholic bishop had given the Catholic Church to the Sandstone Shire for use as a non-denominational church. With that, they had a magnificent centenary ceremony, but they had the church painted on the outside, the old windows taken out, proper, because they were louvers, let in all the red dirt easily. They put in windows with a little bit of lead light round them and clear in the middle, and then they took out the big high altar and put it facing west, put in the most magnificent lead glass window with Christ pouring out Billy tea to people around a campfire. He could have been Arab, part Aboriginal, bronzed Australian. It was just beautifully done. And some animals around that. And it's been so it's become such a tourist spot that they've actually sealed the road from Mount Magnet to Sandstone, which is about 120 k's. It was just magnificent. They had got a grant and they were going to polish the floor. I could have told them, don't do that, probably go through it. When they looked at it and decided they'd ran out of money, but they wouldn't do it anyway. But it was just magnificent. We were invited back for the centenary, which was a really something special. Bob, the Anglican man from Mount Magnet, and the Catholic bishop from Geraldton ran a service with Bob, the sort of anchor person. And the Catholic bishop, when Bob asked him about it, said, "Oh, look, I've got to go to Rome. You organise it all, and I'll do whatever you tell me." Well, he started it and finished the service. The Catholic priest, Catholic bishop rather, at the end of the service said, "Can I tell a joke?" "Oh, I'm a bishop, I can tell a joke." And he said, "You know, there was the Catholics in the congregation are sort of looking a bit stunned." He said, "Well, you know, there's a priest coming through a town like, very similar to Sandstone. A little boy comes up with some kittens. He says, 'Good Catholic kittens for sale, Father.' And the father says, 'Oh, look, I'm moving all the time. I couldn't have a kitten, but, you know, God bless you, my son.' Goes on, comes back a few weeks later, and the little boy comes up, 'These good Protestant kittens for sale, Father.' 'Now, wait a minute, you told me they were good Catholic kittens.' 'Oh, yes, but they've got their eyes open now.'" He just about, you know, put the place down. I landed and was taxiing up on a station that was about 2.5 miles, because they still talked in miles, from the station. And I'm taxiing up, and Bob says, "Can you see who's driving that four-wheel drive?" I said, "No, I can't." And out hops a seven-year-old boy. I thought, "Oh, this will be interesting." And so we get in the car, and he's in the driver's seat. Bob's in the front, and he was too small to hold the wheel and bring the clutch up. So let's go to the wheel. And as he comes up, he grabs the wheel and starts off, and we move. And I thought, And so he said, better change to second. So down he goes. Bob goes to steady the wheel, and he gets his hand smacked. And up we come. And he said, I think we'll stay in this gear for the trip. He had a very rough, dry creek to cross, which he navigated beautifully. And we arrived back. I don't know whether, I can't remember whether he drove us back to the plane or Mum did. I can't remember now. And about 3 weeks later, we'd landed at a station where we usually walked in, and the little Suzuki came down to pick us up, and he, another seven-year-old driving us very nonchalantly back. So who's the youngest boy to drive you? He said, oh, it depends whether you or Ben. Oh, he's 3 weeks younger than me. Very disgusted. The girls tended to be about nine, not because of gender bias. It was simply that they were tended to be smaller and really couldn't manage, because most of them were big four-wheel drives. And, of course, they could drive anywhere on the station because they went gazetted roads. Now, we had an 11-year-old girl, and Mum and she were the only ones at home, and her brother and dad, brothers and dad were out on the run. And one of the dogs got hurt. And Mum bent down to see what was wrong, and the dog bounced up. I mean, they were all well, fine normally, but he bounced up and bit her just on the nose, just the eyes. So, because her eyes swelled up, no time flat. So, daughter goes and gets the four-wheel drive, drives Mum 100 k's into Meekatharra, up past the police and up to the hospital. And Mum, a couple of hours later, comes back with eyes all right. And thinks, I better drive out of town. So she drove past the police station and out of town, but not very far, and handed back over to the daughter. And they were very competent, the children. They had to be careful for little children, because it's very easy to get lost once you're out of sight of the homestead. So they used to... In the Murchison Patrol, changed in the Gascoigne. In the Murchison Patrol, they would leave their children toddlers barefoot, and sweep the yard, because there were huge bindi eyes that would go right through your shoe. Keep it swept, and if a child escaped, the squawks would very quickly bring Mum because they were into the bindi eyes. That we didn't have a lot of snakes. Well, certainly around the yard, they wouldn't have had a lot of snakes. So they were safe from that. But they would then teach their children that if you are lost, follow a track to the fence, and then you follow the track along the fence, doesn't matter which way, because you'll come to a windmill, and we'll come and find you. Well, a nine-year-old girl she'd had permission to go for a walk in the bush. She was lost, and so she did this, walked the wrong way, ended up the windmill and had a drink, curled up and slept for the night because it was late. Next morning, oh, I know where I am, and was nearly home by the time they were found up. They weren't unduly worried because they knew the rule. She knew the rules. Mm. But in the Murchison, I mean in the Gascoigne rather, they had a lot of snakes. So they had to be more careful about littlies. So they would put little high boots on them, and then they really had to just keep an eye on them all the time, which is very difficult if you're teaching other older children's school, because they only get half an hour. Or this has all changed, but this is then. They only get half an hour on air, and Mum's the teacher for the rest of it. So really they had to keep the toddlers in with them at that stage. So it was a bit harder. We saw so many snakes in the Gascoigne, it was incredible. I only had two in the 9 years. I had one. We were camping out one night. Instead of flying, we'd driven. And it was a lovely night, and you couldn't put a shower bucket up on a tree because the trees weren't tall enough. So we had a shower lead round with holes and go, leading down to a pump, and just pumped water up and had a shower that way. And I'm having this in a lovely moonlight night, beautiful weather, and a snake appeared and put his head over the bowl. And I looked at him and said, "But get off, go off. It's night time and snakes don't come out at night." And of course he buzzed off. And I'd already found Bob had, before I went to go, we'd been sitting down and Bob had said, "Just look under your chair before you go and have a shower." And there was he could hear a centipede moving. He was so big. So that was an interesting night. The other one, I was at the Landor races, which picnic races, which are a bit like the, they had old bushes coming up and all the bush people went, didn't have lots of tourists. And we were camping with one of the stations and I had sandals on and I felt something on my feet. Another man over there and some little kids running in and out. They were saying something, neither of us are taking much notice of it. And I felt this and I tipped my feet and looked down and there was this snake. I did know this was a crate and a very, very venomous snake. And but as I did this, my person over there looked down and he had his riding boot on the snake immediately and the next man got a spade and killed it straight away. And the children were actually saying, "Nake, nake, nake, nake." We weren't taking any notice. I would have been all right if it had bitten me because we had the RFDS there. Was a very nasty snake. So that were the only two I saw in Mika. The women were magnificent. They helped their husbands on the station when needed because these were very marginal stations. And so they didn't have, most of them, a few did, but most of them did not have extra staff. It'd be one family or occasionally two generations. And so they had to teach school, run the household, remembering they didn't have electricity all the time in those days, they do now. So it was a very long day and very hard work, and they did not see many women. When the telephones took over from the RFDS, they used to have to ring in about 7 o'clock each morning to the RFDS before the telephones came on. And they would do a roll call and make sure that everybody was okay. Now, most of the stations left the radio on, bubbling away all day. So they'd hear if somebody broke their leg or they just had a baby or whatever, or good news. When the telephones came on, they were one-to-one. Because with the RFDS, they'd have a galah session. Now, I might be talking to you, but everyone would be listening. And there was occasion when if you'd just come in with a new baby on 1 million acres and you were on your own with a new baby and they'd had a rotten night, at least if I'm ringing another mum, "No, look, it's okay. That's a normal thing." Mm. Or "I think you better ring the RFDS." But everybody would be listening, so they'd be giving advice. Right? Now, when the telephones came in, it's a one-to-one. Not only that, it was mostly a trunk call in those days. So they weren't used to timed calls. They'd have a time section, but not timed calls. Mm-hmm. So when the first bill came in and they pulled the husband off the roof, he's saying, "Do not use the phone unless you absolutely have to." Now, you can guess who had to use it for business. So these wives got, from competent, confident people, I could see them getting really depressed and underconfident. So I got a grant from the Western Australian government to go and explore, because we were the last to get the telephones, last state. So I went to explore what was happening in the other states. And from that, we ended up with a quarterly magazine, which I think is still going, which gave the area news of each other, even if they didn't get it straight away.
What was that magazine called?
Bush Voices. I think I might have... Oh, I've got several, couple of copies. And that helped. I also saw Telstra. They were all Telstra. I saw Telstra and asked them if they could have five nominated people, each person pick a different five, that they could ring not as a trunk call and untimed. Could that be done technically? Yes. Right, that's what is needed desperately.
Fantastic.
No. I've tried very hard. No, they might block the line. I said, yeah, it probably would for a month. These people are very busy and they certainly would for a little while. But after that, they're too busy for that.
Mm.
No, could not get it. Just would not do it. And I had hoped that our frontier services that we worked for, it used to be called the old AIM, under that John Flynn started. Then after uniting, it became Frontier Services. I hope they did have some family workers for families in Queensland with small children, and I'd hoped we could get one going in the West, but they couldn't afford it, unfortunately. The West is so big, and they knew if they started in one place, they'd have to have a lot.
Have to roll out. Yeah.
And they just couldn't do it. And so that didn't work. But the Bush Voices did help. There's all sorts of stories, but you've probably heard enough. Bob did got a grant from the Western Australian government to check what the very, very remote Aboriginals wanted for their education for their children. He would have done a great job if he'd done it on his own. The government sent two government people with him. He explained to them before they went that he would ask the question, they would sit in the dirt and not open their mouth for at least an hour. Then they would be ready to talk about it or even give them their answer. They sat down, 30 seconds later, would you like a playgroup? I had no idea what a playgroup was, but if we were offering one, yes. It was just, he finally found a nurse who'd been on a remote area for about 20 years. And she said, I can tell you, they want their children to be able to read and write and enough arithmetic to be able to work the store. Full stop.
So how did that evolve then?
Well, he put that in his report. This was unfortunate towards the end of our time there. I don't think the government learned anything.
Have you been back since?
I went back in April this year. For the first time, I went back to one of our stations called Ulleen, very interesting station, which is regenerating. It's the only one in the area, and it's on the internet, and it's worth looking at. I'd known the current son of the previous person running it. I knew him as a senior student at school. I only knew him in holidays. And so I had rung him and asked him if I could take Bob's ashes back. And he said, yes, certainly. Where do you want them, Jenny? And I said, I have no idea, because we visited people, not the station as a whole. And you'll have to just give me somewhere to put them. So I went back over Easter. It was my third time to try and get there because of COVID. Went up with my married granddaughter and her husband and two girls, and my married grandson with his wife and two girls. And we went to the station, and they suggested, because they have some tourists, they have a map of the station. And so they showed us a way to go down and do some recce and find out where we would like to put him anywhere that was their answer, but we suggest this. So we drove down. It was a gum tree with a table and seats that was next to Lake Willeen when it's full, which it didn't have any water in. Most times it doesn't. Didn't have any water in. But they had regenerated the bottom so that the water wouldn't just come down and take the dirt with it. They had put the grasses in, the original perennial grasses in there. And so it's a lovely spot. And I'm standing under the tree thinking, oh, this is lovely. My granddaughter says, look up, Granny. And I looked up, and there is a beautiful barbed wire heart with several strands. And I thought, oh, I do know what this was, where David and his wife Frances were married. They won't want Bob's ashes here. So we went back, and my grandson-in-law saw her before I did, and she said, she said, what do you think? He said, we loved it, but, you know, I don't think you'll want it there. Oh, yes, that's why we sent you there. We'd love to have him there. So that's where we put him. But it's a lovely... They're doing a great job. David took us as with some other tourists on the sunset tour, and he says it'll never be regenerated fully in his lifetime. And I could see why when we went on the tour. They have to grow the seed, and it becomes small, you know, small plants, and they put the plants, plant the plants in close together. So it's a huge job. He destocked for 4 years, and now I had sheep, now he's gone back, and only has a maximum of about 200 cattle on any one time, so he can move them around before they eat stuff out too much. He brought back dingoes, because the goats, feral goats, are an absolute menace on the stations.
Really?
And kangaroos have also become a menace because there are so many more watering holes now from white people that they've built up in numbers. Well, the dingoes came back, and they have got rid of the feral, virtually got rid of the feral goats, and they've got the kangaroos in balance again, which is great. Pastoralists around them were a bit worried. They have no sheep around them, so there wasn't a worry about bringing any dingoes in. They were a bit worried about the dingoes eating calves. David says they might occasionally, very occasionally, take a calf, usually one that was going to die anyway.
Would it be fair to say that these are really, really great times?
Oh, yes, yes. My whole life's been a great time, really. I'm a member of the Embroiderers Guild. I've been president there. I was president while we were in the Air Force of the RAF Women's. That was my first presidency. I was terrified. RAF Women's Association. They've now unfortunately closed, but we used to raise money for children of deceased or incapacitated airmen. The Embroiderers Guild. I've got an embroidery I'll show you later. Most of them I've given away. I've loved that. I've been involved with Girl Guides since Malaysian days. I'm actually a life member. These sort of things, I mean, I actually ended up as president of the CWA in Meekatharra, and we built the old house had been bought in 1946 for, I think it was £90. It was an old miner's cottage. Mm-hmm. And in those days, you didn't bring up more building material than you had to. So they'd put the frame up and line inside, put a veranda around most of it because it was too expensive to bring up outside cladding. It had one bedroom, a living room, kitchen at the back, and a veranda around across the front and down one end and part of the other. And an outside loo and a bathroom. Well, had a bathroom. It was gone. The building was there, but it was decrepit. And so when I was president, we had the spurt of mining people and the membership grew, and we decided to try and get a new home. First year we had a big fete and raised $5,000, which was a lot in a small town. We ended up with, over 3 years, ended up with 30,000. CWA had said they would grant us 10 and give us a loan of 15, and another branch gave us a loan of 5, interest-free. And we got hold of a transportable with second-hand transportable. It had carpet and curtains and blinds and a clothesline, and we had to get new leach drains. That was expensive. It had a carport, I think, memory. So we put that up, and I'd left before we finished paying off the 20,000, but they paid that off in 2 years. And so that was great, because we had, as well as our manse, we had a big double garage that had been made into a living area with shower and toilet and kitchen. And then station people often stayed with us or in what we called our loan centre. CWA, that gave them another spot that they could come in and stay. We did a lot of it by running, and I wasn't involved, but a lot of our people were running an op shop. We used to have one white man who used to come in and get his undies and his shirts every week. So that was a very successful enterprise that went there.
Does it feel like it's a long time ago, or these times and memories are fairly fresh?
Well, because I've been writing the book, doing the book, and I've got, we sent out a quarterly letter, and so I've been going through the letters and working on books. So I've just been reading a lot of the chapter. I haven't done all of them. I've finished a couple. And I've had to go through all the letters we sent out and mark in the margins things that, you know, women or children or guns. That was in the chapter. We had a murder and a near murder and a suicide while we were over there. It's fairly fresh because I've been reading a lot. It's still got quite a long way to go. But that's brought up some of these stories that I probably wouldn't have thought of. I think I've been helped a lot by the fact that so many people, not just Air Force, people here, because we were here for nearly 5 years before Bob died, probably 4.5 before he wasn't seeing so many people, but you know, so many people, including some men, saying, oh, I really loved Bob. There's been so much, and as you saw, so much affirmation from the Air Force. He was given a great send-off, so, you know, it's not easy, but it's made easier by that. And there's a photo in April. He died in September, but in April, May, we went to Canada, and that did the trip around the Rockies, and he's 90 at that stage when we had a Harley Davidson ride. That was great fun. It was in Jasper.
Can I ask you, because from everything you've just shared with me over the last hour or so, it seems like you changed address quite frequently.
Yeah, well, this was our 24th move.
Resigned.
I mean, that meant coming back to our house in King William Road, but you know, we'd moved to Meekatharra and had to came back to it. Then we sold that and moved 3 doors further down, and then we moved over here.
24 moves, that's quite a lot.
You get used to it. You don't ever like them, but you get quite good at it. It's a bit like Bob when he was in Mary Potter Hospice. He said to one of the doctors, oh, I was put in here to die, but I'm not very good at it, am I? You get very good at moving. That was one when as a pilot, he was frightened of heights, and I could not understand that until I learnt to fly. And when I'd say to him, I don't understand how you can fly, he said, oh, but the plane's strapped to me, that's okay. And I didn't think he'd ever want to climb the bridge, and I was going to climb it without him. But he said, no, it's all right. I can see you're hooked on all the way and you're not right at the edge. I don't think he ever looked down. He looked out.
We're looking at a photograph here of yourself and Bob Was that a good experience? Oh, that was fun.
That was great fun. So was this. They were great fun. We got known here a bit with old Jenny and Bob.
And what about travelling in general?
We didn't really start travelling overseas till after we moved in here. We sold property in King William Road for leaving us enough for a new car and a bit of travel as well as here. And we were to go, as I said, we went to in April 19, and we were to go to New Zealand in November 19, but Bob died in September, so I'm hoping to go in December, 26th of December this year. We also were booked for a hot air balloon ride, and that was probably early March 19, and it got put off twice because of wind, and so I decided in this year that I better go and take it up. So I went in March and did the hot air balloon ride. That was great. That was very good. I wondered how it would be as a pilot. I had done one glider ride, but not having an engine, and I take off and doing it was fine, and I'm sort of having a careful look. Once I knew which way the wind was going, I'm having a careful look to where we're going to land. A bit concerned about landing, but it was fine. We landed in a paddock with some other cattle, most of whom ignored us. You again. But one of them came over and actually licked the basket. We'd been out of the basket, and the basket was back on the vehicle that was towing it. Licked the vehicle, looked as if he might come and lick us, and then walked around us and stood watching the whole time we rolled up the balloon. So that was fun. And the landing was good. They don't go when the wind's high, so it's fine.
Mm. Any other adventures planned or on the horizon?
Well, I'll go to New South Wales before Christmas, have Christmas with one of the family. I've got all this family. I've got the four children, 15 grandchildren and 14, soon to be 16, great-grandchildren, and not one in South Australia. So they're scattered all over the place. Married grandson in Sweden who's expecting their first baby. Granddaughter in New York, the rest at the moment are all in Australia. I had a daughter and son-in-law in Japan for about eight years. They've been all over the place. They move more as much as we do, but the rest are all, daughter in Townsville, all over the place. So I'm going over to New South Wales before Christmas, and we'll trot around New South Wales. Have Christmas there, and then hopefully, provided COVID doesn't interfere, and leave on the 26th of December to go to New Zealand. Fantastic. And then my daughter and I from Townsville are going round the coast of the Kimberleys by ship in April next year. I know Kimberleys very well, because I know most of Western Australian holidays we'd get to see west of Western Australia. And we've been twice. We were twice up in the Kimberleys, so know the road part very well, but haven't done the coast bit. So that's all that's planned at the moment.
It's quite a large network of family that you have there. Have you been utilising technology, for example, Zoom quite easily?
Oh yes. Well, not so much Zoom. I use Skype a bit. I use the computer all the time. So I had to learn internet banking when Bob died because I hadn't done that. But that's not hard.
Do you have any words of advice for the younger generations of today?
Live each day, I suppose. Enjoy life and live each day as much as you can. Enjoy it.
You've seen so many things that the majority of people have never seen or experienced. It's wonderful. Jenny McIntosh, thank you so much for speaking with me today. It's been an absolute privilege to meet you and to hear your stories. Thank you so much.
That's all right. I babbled on too much, probably.
Not at all. No, not in your Nelly.
If you or someone you know would like to be captured in a podcast, contact Christian Teusner via this email address, theemutree@gmail.com. theemutree@gmail.com. My name is Christian Teusner. Thank you for listening.